Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, May 15, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call on First Amendment protection for non-media speakers. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We welcome to our call today two experts who are going to lead us through our topics. They're going to begin with opening remarks, each of about 8 to 10 minutes, then some back and forth. But as always, we'll be looking to the audience for your questions, so please do be ready with those questions when we get to that portion of the program. We're going to hear first from Professor Sonia R. West. She's a professor at the University of Georgia School of Law, and she'll be followed by Professor Eugene Volokh. He's the Gary T. Schwartz Professor of Law at UCLA School of Law. And with that, Professor West, please go right ahead with your opening thoughts.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I want to thank you, the Federalist Society, for organizing this event and for everyone who has called in to listen. We look forward to your questions and, of course, to Professor Volokh for the discussion I hope we're about to have. So we're here today to talk about the First Amendment, which, as I know we're all familiar with, tells us that Congress can make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. And I think we have a generally pretty good idea of what the first part of that means, the freedom of speech. The court has given us a lot of information. We have very robust speech protections. It's something that we all enjoy as Americans. The question, however, is about the second part, the freedom of the press, and it's much less clear what exactly that means and what kind of consequences or effects it could have. So it has a question as just as a constitutional issue. Does the press clause bring with it particular rights and protections that are distinct from those protected by the speech clause? If so, what are these rights and protections, and who gets them? Does everyone get them, or does only a certain type of speaker or a certain type of entity enjoy these particular rights? So there's a lot to talk about here, but what we should start with maybe thinking in terms of defamation, because there's been a number of cases recently dealing with some of these issues in the context of defamation. And again, as something a little basic that I'm sure we're all quite familiar with, just last year we had the 50th anniversary of the Supreme Court's case in New York Times versus Sullivan, where the court told us that the First Amendment places limitations on how states can enforce their defamation laws. Then a string of cases came after New York Times versus Sullivan, but they gave us this structure, this doctrine, telling us that when we have issues of defamation, there's a couple of things that we look at to decide what kind of burden we're going to place on the plaintiff in order to prove their defamation case. One of the most important things that the courts look at is the status of the plaintiff. Are we dealing with a public official, a public figure, limited purpose public figure, a private figure? All of this is very important because it tells us what the level of fault that must be proven about the speaker is. It can be anything from negligence to actual malice. They also, in some cases, look at the subject matter. Are we dealing with something that is a matter of public concern, or is it totally a private concern? But what we've had courts lately dealing with is a third question, which is, should it matter who the speaker is? Does it matter if this person is someone we would consider press or non-press or media or non-media or however you want to think about it? And we've had a couple different courts look at this. Professor Volokh's been involved through his clinic in a number of these cases. We had a case out of the Ninth Circuit last year where we had a blogger who was writing things about a bankruptcy trustee saying they committed tax fraud and engaged in a Ponzi scheme. The court there said we were dealing with a matter of public concern, but we had a private figure, but said to us it doesn't matter who the defendant was here, who the speaker was, whether they were media or non-media. That's not a line we should be drawing, and we shouldn't be looking into that. That can be contrasted with a more recent case out of Texas just this year, which actually involved a bat sanctuary, of all things, and we had a place where they try to protect and care for bats, and we had a former intern at the bat sanctuary allege all sorts of various things about the people running it and its leader, said that they didn't care for the animals, and the court said here that we had private figures, We had a matter of public concern dealing with animal cruelty, but then and for one part of the issue decided, does it matter or whether or not we're dealing with a member of the media in terms of the speaker? The court there said it does matter, and this particular person was not a member of the media, and therefore we, in that case, changed the burden that the plaintiff had to prove to make it an easier case for them since they weren't dealing with the media. So all these cases demonstrate, I think, some overarching questions that come up when we're dealing with this thought about the press and constitutional status for the press as to other kinds of speakers. One is whether or not courts should be in the business of distinguishing press or media speakers from other speakers. Another question is, what do we do when the legislatures have made this distinction between media and non-media speakers, when we have statutes that do so? And then finally, if we're going to be in this business of defining the, of separating them, how do we go about the business of defining them or drawing this line between media and non-media or press and non-press speakers? Now, I've written a number of pieces, some articles, basically making the arguments that we can and should make these distinctions, and that making and defining them, this definition problem, is indeed a workable problem. I think there are, wanted to start with some areas where I believe Professor Volokh and I are actually in agreement. One is that to the extent I think we can define these two groups, I don't think the medium of communication is relevant. I don't think it should matter how they choose to convey their thoughts. So along those lines, I think the Ninth Circuit was correct, that the fact that someone was a blogger and did their speaking on the internet versus in a newspaper or some other medium should not matter. I don't think that is important. I also don't think, and I believe we're in agreement here, that impartiality needs to be required. There's a Florida case where a court found that something called the Society for Science-Based Medicine, there for statutory purposes, they concluded they were the media. I think that was correct because in that case they said they were functioning to provide information to the public, even if they did have a particular mission. I also personally, and I'm different from some other scholars on this line, I don't think we can draw a line specifically between an institutional press and everyone else. I do have concerns about drawing a harsh institutional lines because I think it does have the potential to silence certain types of viewpoints and certain types of speakers. I propose a far more functional approach, although I do think the institutional line can be, in some cases, a helpful proxy, but it should not be the ultimate line. And another area where I think we agree is that I think we both have the goal in that what we want from our constitutional structure is to maximize speech and information flow to the best of our abilities. We have robust speech clause protections. They are for everyone, and I think that is for the best, important, and should be strongly protected. So in that case, I also think that the Texas court here that found that the intern, former intern, was not a member of media and therefore made it easier to sue that person for defamation, I think that was wrong, particularly since they had already decided that we were dealing with a matter of public concern. What my scholarship is focused on and what I'm concerned about are situations where, because we will not draw this line, because we are afraid of separating certain kinds of speakers who are fulfilling certain functions, what we have are situations where then we decide no one can get particular kind of right or access. This is usually in news gathering situations where, for example, the court had a couple of cases involving getting access to prisons, among other things. You know, one of the arguments is we're trying to run a prison here. We can't just open it up to anybody who wants to come in and look around. But we had situations where reporters really had reasons to think there might be something problematic going in on the prison. And here's a situation where I think if we could divide it, we could say you don't have to let everybody in. We can let certain people who are fulfilling certain functions as representatives and surrogates for the public go gather information and report it back to us. And then we would get a net gain of information. So my concern is that by failing to make these distinctions, we are actually getting certain costs. We are reducing our flow of information in some situations, weakening our ability to scrutinize the government, and those are concerns that I have. Areas where I think we have disagreements that I'm sure we'll talk about, we do disagree on sort of what the basic meaning of the press clause is, the best way to further that meaning. And then, of course, there's this issue, again, of definition. If we are going to distinguish, in some cases, press speakers from non-press speakers, how are we going to define it? I do believe this is a problem that is workable. This is the biggest objection that you hear about why we can't do this. It is called untenable, a difficulty of the highest order, the Supreme Court once said. But we do define constitutional terms all the time. We do so even imperfectly, even in the First Amendment context. Even as I just discussed in defamation, the courts have to make a decision if someone is a public figure or a private figure, and the discussion that they have has a very important impact on our speech and expression rights, yet we let them do that. We're comfortable with that. Same with trying to figure out if something is a matter of public concern or private concern. Courts, the government makes this decision, has a very big impact on our speech, yet we go forward with that. So it's a little unclear why we can't also draw this line when it comes to who are the speakers who are functioning in a particular way, as the press, and those speakers who are not functioning in that way. So I will stop there, and I look forward to hearing the rest of the conversation.
Great.
Go right ahead, Professor Vollett.
Great. Professor S., thank you very much for your presentation. Let me start with a little bit of history and then move on to the functional points that Professor West was making. So if you look at the framing era sources, and you can look at them, they're all available online. I shouldn't say all, many of them are available online. Great, perhaps even tedious detail in an article of mine on the subject on freedom of the press as technology. What you find is that the freedom of the press was understood as the freedom to print, the freedom to use the printing press. The press at the time, in fact, if you look at our framing era dictionaries, you find the press was generally not used, or at least it was just at most it was beginning to be used to mean the media, like ladies and gentlemen of the press. It was at the time used to mean the physical device, which would press on the paper and make imprints on the paper. As a result, the freedom of the press was the freedom of everybody, to be sure everybody either owned a printing press or could get access to a printing press, to use the printing press. If you look at the grammar of the clause, and it is one clause, the free speech press clause, you find that it points very much in the same direction. It protects the freedom of speech or of the press. Speech is not a group of people, obviously. Speech is an activity. So freedom of speech is really the right to speak, the freedom of everybody to speak. It would be very odd if freedom of speech or of the press, again, one clause, was understood as meaning freedom of everybody to speak plus the freedom of some specialized group that's in the press business. And in fact, if you look at the framing era sources, they pretty much unanimously take the view that freedom of the press, again, belonged to everybody. It belonged, if you look at sources from the 1780s all the way up to about 1840, which is where I mostly looked at for the first part of my paper, what you find is that you have free press being used, free press arguments, liberty of the press arguments, the claim that there's a legal doctrine, freedom of the press, that protects this, being used not just by people who are in the newspaper business, but by politicians, by ministers, by business people who are arguing with each other about the supposed breaches of business ethics, and courts applied the free press clause there to all of those. To be sure, the free press protection back then was not as strong as it is now, just as free speech protection wasn't as strong as it is now, but there was no hint there that, well, you don't get to use the free press clause because you're merely a businessman or merely a minister or a politician. In fact, in 1827, there was a court decision that specifically said that newspaper editors have no, quote, other rights than such as are common to all, close quote. Saying, yes, the Free Press Clause does protect newspaper editors, but precisely to the same level as it protects anybody else. And then starting with about the 1850s, that became basically unchallenged, oft-repeated orthodoxy. Newspaper editors repeatedly tried to claim special free press clause rights, generally in libel lawsuits, and courts routinely rejected that. And if you look at treatises from the early 1900s, it just repeated without, just because so many cases had said that. So up until around 1970, I could find basically not a single case that took the view that the Free Press Clause protects an industry or profession or occupation of the press. There were some cases that basically treated free speech and free press interchangeably, because by 1970s, in part because of the advent of mass communication technologies, which were, you'd think would be press, but which used audio or video, like films, like broadcasting and the like, the two clauses ended up being collapsed in common usage. So you find cases that use free speech and free press, or free speech to cover everything, including freedom of the press. You find some cases that say, well, freedom of speech is the freedom of in-person communication. Freedom of the press is the freedom of mass communication, using the printing press and its technological errors. But you don't find any cases that take the view that freedom of the press belongs to a particular industry or even to people characterized by a particular motivation. Then starting in 1970, we have basically about a dozen or so lower court cases that do indeed say the Free Press Clause provides special protection to the media, and, for example, non-media speakers don't get the protections offered by the Gertz v. Robert Welch case, which is a libel case that deals with criticism of private figures. It's a handful of such cases, some of them libel cases, some of them other cases. The Supreme Court since 1970 has never once held that the Free Press Clause provides any special protection to any particular group. And in fact, it has rejected that position, most recently in Citizens United, but also in First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti. Five justices took that view in the Dun & Bradstreet case. Now, to be sure, in five libel cases from the late 1970s to 1990, there were footnotes that said, we are not resolving here the question of whether the protections offered by these libel rules apply to people who aren't members of the institutional press. So they flagged that as an open question. I got to admit that's what they did, but there's not a single Supreme Court case that actually resolves that question in favor of this notion that the Free Press Clause provides special protection to some. And in fact, as I said, there are many Supreme Court cases during that era that reject such special protection, most recently, as I said, Citizens United in 2010. So I think the history, the tradition, the legal rule is very much on the side of the view that freedom of the press belongs to everybody. It's not unlimited, of course, for anybody, but nobody can claim special protection of the freedom of the press because they are members of, quote, the press, close quote. That's not really, that kind of argument is a pun. It's sort of the notion, well, you know, there's freedom of the press, but now we have something called the press, so it specially protects the press. It ends up being, if you look at it in historical context, a play on words, because the original understanding and the traditional understanding from almost all of American history has been that, again, the freedom of the press protects the technology of the printing press and its technological heirs. Now, it's true, as Professor West pointed out, that while on the one hand it means that nobody's going to be left behind as a result as well, you're a second-class speaker, you're a corporation, for example, and if you're a business corporation, you don't get to speak, but if you're a media corporation, you do get to speak. So this principle of Free Press Clause applies equally to everybody, prevents certain speakers from being left behind. But it also prevents certain speakers from being given an extra benefit that sometimes we might find valuable. For example, one reason that the Supreme Court was hesitant about adopting a journalist's privilege to refuse to disclose sources is this fear that anybody could then end up claiming it, which would make it too broad, and that there's no principled way in which the Supreme Court could say, well, you're a journalist and you're not. So I think it's true if what you're looking for is maximum protection for communication, you might want to give the court some wiggle room, despite this history and tradition, to say, well, somebody is the member of the press, so they get this extra protection. It wouldn't be feasible to give it to everybody, but we can give it to these people because they are so important to public debate. Although the cost of that, of course, is the courts could end up using similar reasoning to back on protection of those who are not favored. But I do think that ultimately the attempts to distinguish the press from others, even if we wanted to buck this history, this original meaning, this long-standing tradition, I think ultimately are a mistake. I think that the problems with drawing the line between the press and others are not that the line can't be drawn. You could draw it. Some statutes actually do draw it. Some of them are very specific. They say you have to be a work in in news gathering dissemination at least X hours a week. A few statutes that provide special protections to the press do in fact actually put it exactly that way. So you could draw those lines. I just don't think they would be particularly principled lines, and I think they would be dangerous lines. So, for example, a very common reason that people want to draw the lines is because they want to restrict the political speech of corporations. And somebody says, well, if you want to restrict the political speech of corporations, then the theory that corporations are not are not protected by the Constitution since they're not individual human beings, well, then what about the New York Times? That's run by a corporation. And then people, in this case, this is actually Justice Stevens' dissent in Citizens United, say, oh, no. The New York Times is a member of the press. It gets free press clause protections, even if other corporations don't get them. So the theory would be only individuals have free speech rights, free press rights. Corporations could have, but only media corporations. Well, the trouble there is then courts will be in the business of deciding, essentially, which corporations count. Does Citizens United itself, which actually produces media information, counts? And I think that kind of line drawing is very likely to turn on who is it that whose speech do we like? After all, business corporations try to convey information about much of the same stuff that media corporations do. They, of course, have their own biases. Business corporations have their own biases, but as Professor West pointed out, opinionated speech is constitutionally protected too, and naturally the media have their own biases as well. Now, I don't think that's the line that Professor West proposes. I understand Professor West's line has to do with kind of the motivation of the speaker, whether the speaker is trying to kind of to inform the public. But either that will end up covering virtually everybody, because why would anybody want to use mass communication technology if they aren't trying to inform the public? Or some kinds of attempts to inform the public will be seen as more worthy. Well, you're trying to inform the public in an unbiased way. You're trying to inform the public in a public-spirited as opposed to privately selfish way. You're trying to inform the public about important things and not less important things. And those kinds of lines, you know, maybe you could try to draw them. I just don't think that courts should be in the business of drawing these kinds of lines when it comes to constitutional protection. So I think here we ought to stick with the judgment of the of history, of tradition, of the original meaning of the Free Press Clause as it has been written, really of precedent. Pretty much all of the traditional constitutional tools of interpretation, again, not just original meaning, but also tradition, also precedent, also text, I think all point in the direction of saying, just as freedom of the speech is freedom of everybody to speak, freedom of the press is the freedom of everybody to speak using mass communications. And to the extent that one thinks, well, that should be trumped by kind of important policy arguments in favor of providing some special protection in some cases to some speakers, I think actually those policy arguments also cut the other way. And cut in the direction, that is to say, of the history and the tradition that I've outlined. So with that, I think there's time for Q&A.
Terrific. I do want to give Professor West a chance to respond, but before we go there, let me open the floor to questions so people can begin lining up. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement. They'll say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, simply push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So if you have a question for either of our experts, our lines are wide open at this point. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Professor West, why don't you take a minute or two to respond to or extend your remarks?
Okay, thank you. Yeah, a few things, but I'll try to be brief because I know we both do want to get to the questions. In terms of the sort of original understanding of what the press clause means, a huge number of the scholars over the last many decades who have looked into this issue actually conclude that the evidence is at a minimum extremely unclear, that there's just not a lot to go on in terms of exactly what the original meaning was of the press clause, that there wasn't a lot of debate, and there's evidence sort of pointing in different directions. One of the things, though, we do know is that a lot of the original state constitutions that included rhetoric that ultimately became, the basis for our federal constitution, included a press clause protection, some sort of press freedom protection, but not speech protection, which at a minimum seems to show to us that there was something special about protecting the press to the framers and the ratifying generation that's different, it seems, than simply the ability to publish our speech. That it wasn't the speech that at least a number of these things were concerned about. It was the press that we wanted to make sure we were protecting, at least a number of these states did, and it seemed that they were trying to capture some other idea. That idea of what they were trying to capture primarily appears to be something to do with checking the government. That seemed to be the ultimate goal that keeps coming back is this ability to check the government. Some amount of personal expression is also certainly mentioned, but this ability to have this particular kind of structural check on the government is very important. That's not inconsistent with an idea of everyone having publication rights, but it does sort of suggest that since this was what they were talking about and focusing on this idea of the press is different. But I certainly don't disagree. The press as we knew it did not exist during the ratifying generation. It was something that developed later. But the press, the technology they used was also very different from what we have today. It was used in very much more limited ways by certain people and in certain ways. It was not something everyone had in their pockets or in their homes to be able to talk about anything that they wanted to be talked about. They were clearly thinking about the press as something very different than what we have today with mass communication technology. As far as the Supreme Court precedent, I also will agree it's true that the court has not explicitly given press rights in cases. There are a number of cases where they do seem to treat the press differently, involving taxation, protections of editorial discretion. But one thing you do notice if you look at the rhetoric of the Supreme Court over the last century is the way they talk about the press, just in their rhetoric. Not only do they talk about the press as being extremely special and fulfilling very important functional roles that are different than the way they talk about speech generally or the ability simply to publish your speech, which the court has found is a right we have under the speech clause to distribute and publish our speech sort of generally or to reach an audience with our speech. But they talk about the press the way we talk about the press in our common discussions. They talk about the press as something you can be a member of. They talk about the press as a thing in a personified way, that the press checks the government, the press interviews people, the press scrutinizes evidence. None of this way of talking about the press is consistent with the idea that it is technology, that we're talking about the printing press could do these things, that you could be a member of the printing press, or that the printing press could take telephone calls, and things that the court has talked about when they talk about the press repeatedly. They also use the term press interchangeably with the news media in their opinions. They frequently talk about the press in the same breath, in the same line as talking about things like newspapers and magazines. Again, very consistent with the way we talk about the press today. We have this long line of the court sort of talking about the press in a way that just doesn't line up with the idea that this was just about being able to use a machine for everyone to publish their press, but rather that it is something different and something distinct. And finally, just my last point that I'll make, in terms about the difficulties of the line-drawing problems, one case I'll just point to is as a comparison in a different First Amendment issue, which involves the free expression, free exercise clause of our religious rights. The court in the Hosanna Tabor case was tasked with the question of trying to figure out whether a particular teacher in that case was a minister for purposes of free exercise clause freedoms. So in other words, they had to decide whether this person functioned in a particular way in order to trigger certain constitutional rights. And in that case, they didn't say, this is too difficult, we could never do this. They didn't say, we can't leave this kind of decision to the courts because we'll open up favoritism for certain kind of religions where we will favor something and other types of religions where we won't favor it. Rather, they said, yes, we can do this. We can look at certain factors. They said we don't have to do it perfectly. We have guidelines we can use. And they also said we can't not make this distinction because we have this constitutional provision, the free exercise clause, and we have to give meaning to it. We have to make it function. If we walked away from this difficult definitional problem, we would be not giving meaning and power to this important constitutional provision. So I think it's just another example of where we have done this in the constitutional terms, where the court does not turn away from the definitional problem simply because it might open up some gray areas or some potential difficulties on exactly how to draw a line.
We've got quite a few people on the line. No questions yet. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's turn back to Professor Volokh. What about that, Professor Volokh? The first point that Professor West made there that I heard, anyhow, that there's a sort of gathering, not just gathering and conveying information to the public is where she would draw the line, but information, I guess, about the government. So that these are people discharging a particular special function, acting as the eyes and ears of the public vis-a-vis the government.
So it's true that the framers thought that the freedom of the press was very important, in part because it allowed gathering information about the government and allowed speech about the government. That is to say, allowed the readers of newspapers to have something helpful to say. They also talked about how the freedom of the press promoted science. So, for example, the Continental Congress's 1774 letter to the inhabitants of Quebec discussed the importance of the freedom of the press as consisting in part of the advancement of truth, science, morality, and arts, as well as politics. So they recognized that the press was a tremendously powerful engine for spreading information, for spreading knowledge. It is surely important to spread knowledge about politics. It is also important to spread knowledge about science and about art and about morality and about lots of other things, in part because they interact ultimately with politics, but even independently of that. So I don't see anything in the history of the Free Press Clause or the text of the Free Press Clause that suggests that its protection are limited to those who want to speak about the government. Nor ultimately do I think that such a line would be particularly easy to, or I shouldn't say easy to administer. I think that such a line would be very hard to administer and unwise to try to administer, in large part, again, because so much of what goes on there, what goes on in other fields, bears on government policy. Consider, for example, the debate about global warming. Is that information about the government? Well, it isn't information about the government, but surely it's information that's tremendously important to government decisions.
We do have three questions pending now, so if you'd like to join that queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our first call of the day.
Yes, hi, it's Claude Laporte, private lawyer. I was curious, Professor West, is the advantage that we get from drawing this distinction the looser libel standards? I mean, it seems to me that the gain from drawing the distinction as a policy matter has to be weighed against the difficulty of drawing the distinction and the potential for abuse of suppressing certain viewpoints.
Right. So you're right that I am concerned about, as I said before, the court has developed over time, you know, this very strong speech protection that we all have, and the court told us in Sullivan to engage in, particularly in sort of public debate, things that have this core public importance, that it's a right we all have, and I feel strongly that should be protected. And because of the way our speech clause has developed and that we have such a strong speech rights now that we consider a right for all speakers, the work that I think is still now left for the press clause to do that would match up with what seems to be sort of the more original understanding about having this this check on this very much more structured and formal check by devoted sort of expert government critics and watchdogs is far more in the news gathering side of things because of our strong speech protections. When any of us speak or publish or broadcast information, we all have strong protections against content-based discrimination, against prior restraints, against protections for libel if we are talking about public figures or public officials. It's the news gathering side of things where we have very few rights or protections. The First Amendment doesn't get us very far when it comes to gathering information, even though the court has given us a lot of rhetoric about how news gathering is a vital step before publishing and broadcasting and checking the government and doing the things that we want the press to do. There's very little affirmative right that we have when it comes to gaining this information. And again, a lot of this does come up because of situations where the court finds that we simply cannot give these kind of rights to everyone. We've already mentioned a few of them, sort of access to government places or government information or government meetings. Professor Volokh mentioned, the reporter's privilege in Brandsburg. The court says sort of we can't just have everybody come and claim a privilege, or our whole system of having grand jury indictments will fail. We can't do that. We also, the press has tried to claim rights to not have searches of their newsrooms, of their work, of its, other kinds of subpoenas. Sometimes minor tort offenses can be issues with reporters who are going undercover to cover the news, and they can be accused of committing fraud or trespass or breaches of duty of loyalty or fiduciary duties. We were having issues lately with leaks. If someone leaks information to a reporter, should that be treated any differently than if they leaked information to a foreign country or to another corporation, if we're dealing with something, should we make these kind of distinctions between what is going on? And currently, when it comes to these kind of situations, we do not. As a general rule, we don't make them because we have this concern about drawing this line. And that's where I would like to see the press clause find some new breathing room here, that in these kinds of situations, in the news gathering situations where currently we say, as a general rule, nobody can have these kinds of rights as a constitutional matter, we can make these distinctions and we can find a way to give certain rights and protections to those who are fulfilling the function of checking the government and informing the public in a regular, efficient manner, that there are some speakers who are simply doing this more regularly, they're doing a better job of it, they have certain expertise, certain resources in order to do this function more than other speakers are. And finding those people and giving them these rights and protections would be this net gain of information for all of us. But I do feel very strongly, you're right, in securing the speech rights that we all already have, and I would be concerned about using that, having that be turned against us in terms of a weakening of those rights.
Professor Volokh, do you want to weigh in here?
Well, so one difficulty is that it's hard to talk about this in the abstract without having a particularly clear definition of what constitutes would constitute the press for these purposes. If Professor West wants to offer a sentence or two, I think that might be useful to for us to discuss it further. Professor, do you want to give us a definition? Doesn't have to be a razor sharp, but one that tells us who is the press and who is not?
Right. So first of all, I will start with a caveat. David Anderson, professor at Texas, who has written about this, he once said that part of the problem is we're 200 years late to this discussion in terms of getting started about thinking about this issue. And I do understand that there would be a lot of things to consider, and I would very much welcome and invite others to think more fully about it. In terms of defining the press, I start with sort of this basic assumption that there are these speakers who fulfill unique roles in our democracy, and those roles are informing the public about matters of public concern and checking the government. These are speakers who devote time, resources, expertise to these tasks. and that they exist and that they are different from other types of speakers, even those who occasionally do act in sort of a press-like manner, who might occasionally use their speech rights to pass along information to others, that there are those who do this in this more regular, established way. And those are the people I would hope to be able to identify.
Well, then I think I have something of an answer. So first of all, unlike many, many other people who back sort of special rights for the press position, sounds like Professor West is endorsing the view that the existing rules with regard to the right to speak, as opposed to, say, to gather information, should apply to everybody. Again, remember, most of the arguments, at least recently, freedom of the press belongs to this entity called the press position, are arguments for restricting corporations from being able to speak unless they're press corporations. Before that, most of the arguments were arguments for limiting libel law protection so that the media gets libel law protection, but ordinary citizens who speak out don't get libel law protection. It sounds like Professor West isn't taking those positions, but again, the danger is that if freedom of the press is seen as belonging to the media, then that'll cut back on the rights of others to speak and not just to gather information. But let's take gathering information. Let's say somebody, for example, there's a debate right now about whether people have the right to photograph in public, and in particular whether they have the right to photograph police officers in public places. And the courts have, over the last several years, come down, I think quite correctly, on the side that it is permissible to photograph and video record and even audio record, although an interesting question is what happens if they audio record in a clandestine way. I think the answer is there, too. People should have the right to record the police. But as I understand Professor West's proposal, news gathering rights would be specially focused on the rights of people who do this for a living. So if you are a journalist and you're zooming down the street, you see a police stop, you start recording it, you're entitled to do that. If you're an ordinary citizen who is recording the information, you're not. I don't really see any basis for that. I don't see why the institutional media, valuable as they are in many ways, should have special First Amendment protections in this kind of context that other citizens do not. In part because individual citizens' speech can often be valuable. First, individual citizens can sometimes act as a check on the media. The media is itself a powerful institution that bears checking. Often it doesn't check itself, and people in the media are reluctant to check the power of other people in the media, not always, but sometimes. So people might want to comment on what the media is doing, but as the police example illustrates, often it is individual citizens who are in the position that they're most able to contribute to public debate, more so than the media, who's not on the spot. So I think if one looks at the specific scenarios, I think one finds that whatever reasons we have for protecting the media ought to extend to reasons for protecting other people who are also trying to gather information or also trying to speak on these kinds of issues.
We've got just one question pending. If you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Hi, my name is Paul Avalar. I'm an attorney with the Institute for Justice. I guess my question is for Professor Volek, which is, you said that the courts should avoid trying to draw these lines between who is media or press and who is not, but there does seem to be one area of law that in which the legislatures are forcing that question on courts, and that is in the campaign finance world, where most all campaign finance laws, including federal law, has a whole host of regulations for people who engage in electioneering, but also have a media or press exemption. And it is then left for the individuals or the regulators and ultimately the courts to figure out who falls under that. And I was thinking of this only because most recently the Tenth Circuit ruled that Citizens United was likely could likely take advantage of the media exemption in Colorado because of their activities and what they did looked like media. So I'm wondering if you have any comments on that. What should courts do when presented with these sorts of questions? That seems one area in which the courts can't duck this line unless they simply say that drawing the line is unconstitutional.
Sure. So there are two things going on in that question. One has to do with what one might call statutory speech protections. There are statutory rules. Some of them are statutory rules that give people rights that pretty clearly wouldn't be normally First Amendment rights. For example, rights of access to press galleries in legislative bodies. The journalist privilege is an example where the Supreme Court said there is no constitutional journalist privilege, although some lower courts have ended up disagreeing, oddly enough. But many statutes say, okay, we're going to create this journalist privilege. And we're only going to give it to particular kinds of media outlets. Likewise, sometimes there is a constitutionally permissible speech restriction, or, for example, constitutionally permissible disclosure requirement for speech or some such, and then that requirement is waived by statute for the media. That, too, is sort of an optional speech protection. It's something that the legislature doesn't have to provide, but it chooses to provide. When the legislature does that and comes up with rules that say certain kinds of organizations, often it says newspapers, magazines, or other periodicals, that's a common locution, get this and others don't, I don't think that's unconstitutional. I'm not sure it's always wise, but I think it's permissible for legislatures. Once we're outside of the area of the constitutional requirements for speech protection, once we get into these optional protections, I do think that a legislature is constitutionally entitled to say we're going to do this on a medium-by-medium basis, although, again, there may be good reasons for it not to. Turning to the campaign finance scenario, I think that your question, I think, really highlights the importance of a basic background principle of First Amendment protection for everybody, regardless of whether they're individuals or corporations, regardless of whether they're media or businesses. So up until Citizens United, under the dissenters' view in Citizens United, the courts would have to, as a constitutional matter, decide, look, you are a member of the media, you are a kind of a worthy speaker, we're going to allow you to speak about elections using the corporate form. On the other hand, you're not a member of the media, we're not going to allow you to speak about elections using the corporate form. In fact, actually, the dissenters in Justice White and Buckley v. Valeo prevailed, then even individuals who aren't members of the media wouldn't be allowed to spend more than $1,000 to speak about elections. So I think that would have been a very bad rule, and it's one the court avoided in Citizens United by saying everybody has the right to speak. Now, in Citizens United, the court also said, however, it is permissible for the government to impose disclosure requirements, for example, on speakers and other record-keeping requirements on people who speak about elections. And the exemptions you're talking about these days, post-Citizens United, are essentially statutorily kind of optional but provided by the grace of the legislature that lifts this burden from certain media speakers. I don't think that's a great solution, but I think it is a constitutional thing for them to say. But again, if you look at how it actually plays out, I think it highlights the wisdom of the court in not drawing such a line as a constitutional matter. It's one thing to say, look, we're going to decide if a book publisher has to engage in certain disclosures of money spent because they're talking about an election. We're going to have to decide whether a documentary filmmaker has to disclose certain kinds of information. And there we're going to decide whether they're a member of the media or not, just under the statutory scheme that the legislature had set forth. It's another thing to say, look, if you're not a member of the media, you just don't have First Amendment rights to speak about that at all. And that's the thing that the court avoided in Citizens United by adopting a free press protects everybody position.
Once again, if you have a question, we've got about 10 minutes left. Our lines are wide open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see if anybody rings in, let me take us in maybe a slightly different direction. I'm curious, there seems to be a lot of uncertainty in who has what kind of protection, even in the present regime, who has how much speech protection. This new proposed line drawing might create more uncertainty. It might resolve some of those uncertainties. I wonder if you would, either of you would care to address that and what those uncertainties might mean in terms of a chilling effect on speech. Are there people out there who just don't know
what the levels of protection are or might become under this new regime, and what does that mean for free speech?
Can I actually try to answer that by asking Professor West a question? Professor, thank you very much for giving us the definition that you offered. Can you elaborate a little bit more, please, by giving some examples of speakers who you think wouldn't be press speakers, speakers who you think would not be entitled to Free Press Clause protection because you think they are not sufficiently politically minded or sufficiently kind of constantly engaged in this and are too, perhaps too occasional in their engagement with political issues. That might help us understand what the proposal is and give us a better sense of how to evaluate it.
Sure. In thinking about some just sort of opening guidelines on how we might think about drawing this line, and again, I did look to the Hosanna Tabor case when they were trying to figure out about a minister, because they took this very much approach of saying, we can't define this exactly, but we have some factors that we think are helpful in leading us that way. And some of those factors seem to apply quite well here. They looked at recognition by others. You know, in that case, they said the church there had recognized her as a minister. I think we could gain a lot by, you know, some concept that someone has been recognized by some sort of third party as being a member of the press. And none of these factors is determinative alone. They can just be helpful in finding it. So that would be something that would codify some sort of institutional rights. If you, you know, work for a newspaper and you've, you know, had some press rights, and then you've identified some way. Hosanna Tabor also looked for training or education or experience as a religious leader. I think we can find information here from also from training and education and experience. But for me, the key issue is regularity of publication and some sort of established audience. I don't think you are functioning as the press if you aren't doing it, connecting with an audience, and you aren't doing it in sort of a regular way. So here's where I think you would have, I get asked a lot about bloggers, right? Obviously, that's a big issue. And the question to me would be, certainly some bloggers are functioning as the press. They're fulfilling these important constitutional press functions, and some aren't. And I think we would get a lot there based on regularity of publication and their established audience, how often they're doing this and how many people are they reaching, because, you know, you aren't checking the government if you are having your conversation in a vacuum, and you are not informing the public if you only do it, you know, very sporadically, and you're not doing it at least in an effective way. Those are the types of people I think I would draw a line between. That there are some people who are, like I said, occasionally commenting on public matters in a way, but not doing it in this regular manner and connecting with an established audience. Also, point out a lot of these people don't need the types of press rights and protections I've been talking about, which is primarily on this news gathering side. A lot of people have come to me and they say, I have my blog, I talk about current events, I read things, I do things, and to those people I say, do you try often to get access to government information or meetings that you're being denied? Do you want to use a testimonial privilege that's being denied to you? Are you trying to go undercover to gather information, and you're concerned about torts being applied against you? And usually the answer is no, that these people are just completely being covered by their speech rights, which I'm happy about. And even though they are functioning in sort of this press-like way, they actually don't need or wouldn't utilize any of the types of protections that I've been talking about.
Answer your question? So naturally, self-centered guy that I am, it's all about me. And I'm looking at my history. And maybe you could tell me when I became, if ever, a member of the press. And let's assume you're right. The question is why it matters. Again, under other people's proposals, it would matter a lot because it would have to do with my rights to take advantage of libel law protections, my rights to speak using the corporate form and such. But let's just focus in news gathering and let's focus on the testimonial privilege. I do sometimes get anonymous tips. I do sometimes talk to people off the record. I've never actually had to insist on the journalist privilege in court or news gatherer's privilege in court. And of course, under the current rules, under the the First Amendment, I might or might not have it. California, it's a hard question. But let's assume that that happens. So let's see a little bit about my life. So back until around 92, I was a law student, and I wrote a law review article. Like all law review articles, it doesn't get much of a readership, and it was only one thing. Then I became a law professor, and I started writing law review articles more often, but certainly by no means daily. But I did write them at the pace of maybe a couple of them a year. Well, then I started writing op-eds. And again, for an op-ed, it, usually just my opinion, but it could be something somebody, some tip somebody, that somebody gives me. And I would, let's say, do those four or five, six times a year. Well, then in 2002, I started a blog. And hey, you know, today I like to think it's a pretty successful blog, but it sure didn't start that way. At the very beginning, our blog had very few readers, maybe a couple of hundred readers, let's say, a day. Then it went to thousands, a few thousand a day, and then a few tens of thousands a day. And I have, from the very beginning, posted every day. But I've had co-bloggers. And some of them, my brother Sasha, for example, who's a co-founder, well, he posts maybe on a regular basis, maybe on average once every month or so. Randy Barnett, you know, he sometimes posts more, sometimes less. Well, and then in 2004, we moved onto the Washington Post site. So we're now branded with the Washington Post, although we're not employees of the Washington Post. Am I a member of this constitutionally privileged press? And if so, when did I become it? And what about my co-bloggers, the ones who post every so often?
First of all, like you, I think, are an easy case today, that you would definitely be someone who is fulfilling the press functions. You are absolutely informing the public about important, matters of public concern. You're checking the government and checking the powerful through your publications. It would be very easy, and that is the ultimate goal: to find the speakers who are doing those things. And those constitutional goals are things that I have pulled from the Supreme Court discussions about what it is the press does, and they keep coming back to those two things repeatedly, which is why I focus on those. Those are the ones that we would want to find the speakers who are doing those things. Everything else is simply a proxy to try to help us find those speakers, but those are the speakers I think we would be trying to find. So today, you would definitely be doing those things, and other factors would point to us that you are doing those. You have a regular publication, you have a very broad audience, you have been identified by the Washington Post as fulfilling functions by bringing, clearly of importance by bringing that, so others have identified this for you. So you would definitely fall, and again, these are factors too that are, you have a lot of experience doing this, and these are factors that come in certain ways from the court's Hosanna Tabor case, where they used a similar kind of analysis to find out if someone was a minister. Obviously, the tricky question is when it happened, right? When it became the moment. And I won't deny that I don't have the ability to tell you the exact moment that it happened. I think that's a kind of clarity of a precision that we don't require in other types of constitutional interpretation. So I don't think it needs to be required here in order for us to continue to have this kind of consideration. And I do think that functioning as the press is not something you can wake up one day and do. You don't just decide, yesterday I wasn't going this, but today I am, and now going forward I'm going to do this. I do think it. There's nothing wrong with requiring a certain proven record, again, analogizing to functioning as a minister. The court looked to past experience, past issues, past practices in order to gain that, expecting that someone couldn't just, turn on a dime and suddenly become a minister for their free exercise purposes. Sometime in that, right, it did occur, and that would be something I would very much welcome, people to consider. I think it's something if we did start going in this direction that the courts would need to deal with, and I'm sure there would be issues to think about. But today, you are an easy case for me, and to the question about sort of your co-authors and sort of the blog as a whole. Again, I'll have to plead. I don't have the precision today to make every announcement. I think, for the most part, though, to me, you have developed an institution that should have some ability to identify for us the speakers who are fulfilling these functions, and that that would be important information for the courts to turn to. To that extent, I do use institutional theory that I think society builds institutions, and there's nothing wrong for us to use that to gain information. So the extent that you have built this blog and then you have chosen certain people to write for you is valuable information that is perfectly fine for us to take into account as we are trying to determine this. But I can't give you exact answers for every hypothetical.
Got it. But it does sound clear that before I had a blog, back when I was a law professor, I'm still a law professor, but I was just did all my writing as a law professor, so as a researcher, somebody who, instead of putting things out every day, puts things out a couple of times a year, well, that doesn't qualify. This is, by the way, an issue that has come up in journalist privilege cases among those courts that have concluded there is some sort of constitutional privilege, because some circuit courts have. And, you know, interestingly, some of them have said that, well, a documentary filmmaker or a professor or even sometimes a political party or political advocacy group would qualify, even though they don't speak as intensive a basis. But as I understand it, in your proposal, they wouldn't qualify because speaking once a year, even if it fits because it takes you a year to come up with something to say, that's not enough.
I think I wouldn't say that an isolated or sporadic publication or speech would be enough. Now, if somebody makes a documentary film every year and it takes them a year to make each one, that could be a different situation because of, you know, the type of speech they are engaged in.
Well, professors, I'm afraid we're out of time. It's a very interesting discussion. I certainly thank you for joining us today. I want to thank you on my own behalf, but also on behalf of the Federal Society. Thanks to Professor Eugene Volokh and Professor Sonia R. West. Very good to have you here with us. To our audience, thank you for joining us and for your questions as well. Just a note about calls next week. Our schedule is somewhat fluid because we're expecting some decisions from the Supreme Court next week, so it's quite likely we'll be adding to our schedule. But so far we have calls next week on immigration policy and the CFPB. But until our next scheduled Teleform conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.